continue with our brief look at the books of the Old Testament. And if you'll go with me to the book of Job, this actually is, I think, our third lesson in this brief. Not really a survey of the books of Old Testament, but a look at the book of each of the books in the Old Testament for the purpose of understanding what the book is about, how it fits in the prophetic program, and so on. And in our study, we have now worked our way the way over to the book of Job. And if you will recall, go with me to Job chapter 42. This is the verse that really gives you the clue, the hint at what the book of Job is all about. Job chapter 42, verse 10. You want to remember this passage, Job 42, verse 10. It says, "And the Lord turned the captivity of Job." The Lord turned the captivity of Job. Remember that Job is he's the third son of Issachar. He's an Israelite that found himself in satanic captivity, though he did not know what that was all about. He when you read Job chapter 1 and Job chapter number 2, you can see that God is the one who brought Job up to Satan, and Satan did not believe that it was possible for Job to serve God for naught, as he says. And God allows Satan to take Job into captivity, a satanic captivity, and Job doesn't really understand what's going on. He doesn't understand that's what this whole thing is about. In fact, Job doesn't really find out about this until much later on, as recorded in the book and so forth. So what happens here in the book of Job, and again, this is the third lesson that we are looking at, I think the third so far. Once Job is smitten by these plagues and so forth, if you'll go with me to Job chapter 2 now, go with me to Job chapter number 2. And you'll find at verse 11, Job chapter 2, verse 11 says this: "Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came everyone from his own place." And then you're given the names. You have Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Nemethite. For they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. And so what happens, these three, quote-unquote, friends, later he says about them, miserable comforters ye are, but these friends, when they hear about Job's situation, they come to Job, and they're coming with the intention of, from their perspective anyway, with the intention of comforting him and advising him. I guess that might be the way to put it. And we've already seen that each of these guys really gives Job their perspective as to why he's suffering. That's the bottom line. They all have their input as to why Job is suffering. And so you have a series of discourses that take place really through two-thirds of the book here. If you look at chapter 3, the very first one, it says, after this, by the way, this is after these guys have been sitting with him for 7 days. Look back at chapter number 2, verse 13. "So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great." So imagine sitting with Job 7 days and 7 nights, and of course by the end of this, somebody's got to say something and so forth. Well, Job begins. So as you go into chapter number 3, Job expresses his concern. Okay, we're not going to go chapter by chapter. We just don't have the time. It's not the intention and so forth. That you want to do in your own study, you want to read and so forth. But basically what Job begins with, he begins by cursing the day in which he was born, as though that's going to solve anything and as though that explains anything. You can see at chapter 3, verse 1, "After this opened Job his mouth and cursed his day, and Job spake and said, Let the day perish wherein I was born." what a way to start to figure out your problems, you know, and so forth. Now, I don't mean to laugh at him in the sense that mocking him, because certainly we've already seen he lost all his family except his wife, who didn't give him the best counsel, by the way. We've seen that already. But he lost all his family, all his goods, and now he's physically tormented with these sores from his head to the soles of his feet and so forth. And so his relief seems to be, you know, "Curse the day in which I was born. Why did I not perish from the womb?" and so forth. So what happens from this point on, pretty much through two-thirds of the book here, is you have this successive, Job makes the various statements about his calamity, his situation, and things like that. And then each of his, quote-unquote, friends give their reason as to why he's suffering. So look at chapter 4. Chapter 4, now you have, it says, then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said. And of course, Eliphaz is going to give his explanation why Job is suffering. If you go back to chapter 5, Eliphaz is still speaking. So then if you look at chapter 6, now Job replies to Eliphaz's reply. Chapter 6, verse 1, but Job answered and said. And then if you look over to chapter number 8, now the next buddy is going to talk. Bildad, the Shuhite, is going to give his input. And then chapter number 9, Job is going to answer Bildad. And then over to chapter 11, Zophar is going to give his input. And then, of course, at chapter 12, Job is going to give his reply, and so forth. And that sequence basically goes on so that each of these individuals gives three sets of discourses as an explanation why Job is in the predicament that he's in. And all of them, their discourses are not the right answer. They think they know the answer, but all their discourses, all the reasons as to why Job is suffering, it's not the reason. None of them say, you know, Job, the reason that you're suffering, the reason Israel is under such captivity is because this great dispute between God and the adversary about the outcome and possession of this earth. None of them even remotely approach that. They just don't even have the idea. Okay, it's interesting there. Their so-called wisdom to Job. And so as you read the book of Job, it can get a little thick sometimes. And I mean that, you know, people say it's kind of getting thick in here. These three counselors are pretty impressed with their own insight and own wisdom and so forth. But again, it's not the answer. So as you proceed then, again, it's just going to go chapter by chapter. You see each of them given their successive input as to what's going on. And then if you'll go over now to chapter 32, there's another player here who has been sitting listening to all this stuff going back and forth, and his name is Elihu. So chapter number 32, it says, so these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. So again, they each had their turn to give their input to Job. Job gave his discourse and so forth. And then up speaks this young man, Elihu. It says, then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachiel, the Buzite of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled because he justified himself rather than God. Also against his three friends was his wrath kindled because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. And that's an accurate statement of what happened. They didn't know the answer, but they still condemned Job. Now, Elihu had waited till Job had spoken because they were elder than he. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, then his wrath was kindled. And Elihu, the son of Barachiel, the Buzite, answered and said, I am young and ye are very old. That's generally not a compliment, by the way, but in this case it is. It's showing respect and that kind of thing. He says, I am young and ye are old, wherefore I was afraid and durst not show ye mine opinion. I said, by the way, there's also wisdom in that too. You know what I'm saying? You know how sometimes we speak way too soon and it demonstrates how dumb we really are, you know, and that we don't have the answer. He says at verse 7, I said days should speak and multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there is a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the Almighty giveth him understanding. Great men are not always wise. That was probably not the way to win these guys' ears, right? When he says, great men are not always wise, neither do the aged understand judgment. Therefore, I said, hearken to me, I also will show mine opinion. Which he does now. And actually, of the three men that speak, this guy here, Elihu, is probably closest to giving some accurate counsel, though he himself also does not really know and understand what's going on. But at least what he does, he doesn't come along and just blabber a bunch of hot air like all these other guys do, okay? So he says at chapter 33, wherefore, Job, I pray thee hear my speech, and so forth. Chapter number 34, he continues. Chapter number 35, he continues. 36, 37, and so forth. Now there's someone else look at chapter 38. There's someone else that has been listening to all this, all these various discourses all through this, right? And who is it? It's the Lord. And so now you're finally going to get some wisdom. You're going to get the true explanation and answer as to what in the world this is all about. And it is, Job in many ways is not just about the long suffering of Job and the patience of Job, but it's the long suffering of the Lord, as the Lord had to sit here and just listens to all the crazy things that these quote unquote counselors are giving to Job as to why Job is suffering. And so if you look at chapter number 38 at verse 1, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, that, by the way, the whirlwind you want to write down next to that verse, Ezekiel chapter number 1. There are several times in the Old Testament where you see the word whirlwind, the word whirlwind. And if you want an explanation or some further detail about, well, what's the significance of out of the whirlwind? The whirlwind, whenever you see God appearing out of the whirlwind, it's in connection with impending judgment, impending conquering of the enemy and so forth. And so here he answers Job out of the whirlwind being a picture of impending judgment. Remember, what's going on in the book of Job is Job is under satanic captivity, and it's going to take God coming back in judgment to turn his captivity, to judge the adversary, to defeat Satan and so forth, and turn Job's captivity. So it's significant that it says here, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. That's important. And so next to that, just write down Ezekiel chapter number 1, and you'll see the whirlwind, and then when you put that with the rest of the book of Ezekiel, you'll understand what that's about, okay? All right, so look what the very first words out of God's mouth when he addresses Job, he says, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? That's one of the greatest questions God has ever asked any person. Isn't that? See, if you're giving people words without knowledge, you're darkening counsel. You see that there? Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? The words don't have any knowledge in them. There's no knowledge about what's really going on in the words that they're giving. And that being the case, it can't enlighten counsel. It darkens counsel. It darkens understanding. It doesn't tell people what's really going on. And so by contrast, what God is going to do now through chapter number 38, 39, 40, 41, He is going to enlighten Job with words with knowledge. He's going to enlighten counsel. He's going to enable in counsel by giving him words with knowledge. And so at this point, God begins to ask Job all these questions and makes all these statements about what really is going on. And it's interesting that much of it, to a certain degree, is actually in kind of encoded form. How many of you were here when we went through the series on, quote unquote, science falsely so-called? How many of you remember going through that? And remember, we spent a lot of weeks in the book of Job, 38, 39, 40, 41, and so forth. Remember that? And because that is available, you can go listen to it on the internet and so forth. We're not going to go through, and it's not the purpose in these series, to go, you know, verse by verse again and study all this. If you want to go through and look at all the questions that God asks, and then get some insight about these words with knowledge, I would encourage you to go back and listen to that series. For our purpose, we're just going to hit some highlights here as to the nature of these questions. What are these questions designed to do? And you can see right off the bat from the question that God asked Job when he says, who is this that darkeneth counsel with words without knowledge? Well, he's going to give him words with knowledge for the purpose of enlightening his counsel, for the purpose of helping Job understand what is going on here. And he begins by taking Job all the way back to where? All the way back to where? Right back to creation and the purpose of creation. When he says at verse 3, he says, gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. That statement by God to Job, really, you have to appreciate when he says here, gird up now thy loins like a man. We have to appreciate the significance of like a man. What and who is man in the Bible? Who is man? Adam? A creature? In the image of God? To have dominion over the earth. Exactly. man was created for the purpose of being the monarch, the caretaker, the ruler, the governor of planet Earth. That was his purpose. That was his job. If you quickly go to Psalms chapter number 8. Psalms chapter number 8. Go to Psalms chapter number 8 here. Look at this. Psalms chapter number 8. David says at verse 1, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, who has set thy glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou ordained strength because of thine enemy, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger. You see the idea of some conflict going on there, right? And God is doing what He's doing so that He's going to can still the enemy and the avenger. What does He mean to still the enemy, to still in that context? To crush him, to destroy him, to stop him, right? Okay. God does what He does in the heavens and on the earth for the purpose of stilling the enemy and the avenger. There's an enemy out there and there's an avenger. Okay. And God's going to still him. And David says, when I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon, the stars that thou hast ordained. And now he's going to talk about man. What is man that thou art mindful of him? And the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou madest him, why? To have dominion over the works of thy hands. That verse right there tells you the reason why God created man. If you ever have asked the question, or if you've ever had the question asked to you, why did God create man anyway? That verse tells you right there. The purpose for which God created humanity, for which God created the creature called man, is thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. That's why God made man. When God formed Adam out of the dust of the ground, He did so on purpose. And the purpose was that verse right there. To give into the hands of man the dominion over the works of his hands. Now, what does it mean to have dominion?
Authority.
Authority. Good. What else?
Rule.
Excellent. Doesn't He tell Adam to be fruitful and multiply and subdue and have dominion over the earth and so forth? Remember all that? God created man on purpose. And the purpose was that God was going to turn over the works of his hands to man. By the way, and I don't want to get too far off track here, but it is significant that in this context where David is telling us why he created man, David says at the end of verse 2, what? Something about stilling the enemy and the avenger. See that? So not only does God create man for the purpose of having dominion over his hand, over the works of his hands, but he does so in line with his plan and purpose to still the enemy and the avenger. In other words, he doesn't just create man out of, well, what can I do today? I think I'll create a creature called man. He does so because he has a plan and a purpose to still the enemy and the avenger, the rebellion, to stop the rebellion, to destroy the rebellion out of his creation and so forth. And he creates man as part of the outcome of that plan, as part of his purpose to still the enemy and the avenger. Okay? And then it says here at verse 6, thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet. Verse 7, all sheep and oxen, yea, all the beasts of the field. Verse 8, the fowl of the air and the fish of the sea and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the sea. So we learn from that passage the very purpose for which God created man. Now, if man had never fallen, if Adam had never fallen and so forth, then what would Adam and Eve done? What would the race have done? What would they be doing now? They'd be ruling the earth. What's that mean?
Controlling it.
What's that mean? What's that? He would not be ruling it. Good. What else? I mean, man, apart from sin, if the fall never occurred, man would be completely running planet Earth to the glory of Almighty God. This earth has never yet functioned to the glory that God intends it and originally created it to do. As soon as the fall occurred, it was placed under the earth, under the curse. And God put it under the curse so that the adversary who now controlled it would not be able to get the earth to bring forth glory to Himself. Understand that? Romans chapter number 8 talks about that. That the whole creation groaneth and travaileth and together in pain until now. It says, for that the creature was made subject to vanity. What's vanity? Emptiness. It was made subject to vanity, not willingly, not of its own will, but by reason of Him who hath subjected the same in hope. God put the creation under the bondage of corruption in expectation, in hope of something. In absolute expectation that when he releases this creation from the curse into the hands of the glorious liberty of the children of God, the creation will finally bring forth the glory that God intended it to do. God was not going to allow the adversary, who now controlled the earth once Adam fell, once the crown fell off his head, God absolutely prevented the earth from bringing forth glory to the adversary. Now that's amazing when you think about that. Because think about how beautiful the earth is today. Think of, we were just up in Montana at the lake, and that just was just a spectacular spot for a Bible conference. You know, well, I'll have to go next year and so forth. But just think about all the spectacular, beautiful places on planet Earth today. Beautiful waterfalls, beautiful glaciers, things like that. All the creatures. And if this is how beautiful and magnificent and wonderful this earth is in a fallen state, where it's not yet producing to its capacity or demonstrating its capacity to glorify God, imagine what this earth is going to be like once the curse is lifted. And by parallel, think about the heavenly places. You look out in the heavenly places and what do you see? You see darkness and then these specks of light and so forth. Well, imagine what it's going to be like when the light of the glory of God shines throughout the distant regions of the universe. You won't look up from planet Earth and just see nothing but darkness out there. Imagine when the heavenly places themselves also, when the curse is withdrawn from that, taken away from that, and the body of Christ is placed in the heavenly places for the purpose of bringing glory to Christ out there. Spectacular. People talk about how pilots often talk about that fly over the North Pole and things like, or fly around that area. They talk about, I guess, the Borealis effect, the colors out there, and that even from the heavens, sometimes you can see some beautiful things. If you've seen some of the pictures that the Hubble telescope has, that you can go on their website and see some of the pictures about space, and they're pretty spectacular. It's pretty wild. And yet, even all that is still in a fallen, cursed state. Imagine what it's going to be like when that's all lifted. Now, back to Job. When God says to Job, gird up now thy loins like a man and answer them, He's saying, Job, I need you to answer these questions. I need you to think about these questions from the standpoint of being a man. That is, being a person that I created to run the planet. That is, before the fall ever occurred. Job, all these questions that I ask you, I need you to think about them, not from the standpoint of being in a fallen state, though it all is in a fallen state, but from the standpoint of being a man that God created to run the earth. Okay, any questions on that? Any questions on that? So, if you go back to Job 38 then, as God begins to ask these questions to Job, He says at Job 38, verse 4, where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest, or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Now, again, it's not our purpose to look in all the details of the questions, but what's going on there in those verses? What is God asking Job? And not only is what is God asking Job, but in asking these questions, God is conveying, God is saying something to Job, right? What's He saying? When you see phrases like, laying the foundation, measures, stretching upon the line, the foundations are fastened, cornerstone. What do you have all there? What's that? You've got building. You've got intention. You've got design. You've got purpose. You've got measures and so forth. And you can see right from the beginning of the series of questions that God asked Job, He says, Job, you know what? This didn't all just happen by chance. But the evolutionists are wrong. You figured that one out, right? This did not just happen by chance. The earth, it has foundations. When I laid all that out there, there's a measuring line. There's some thought behind all this. There's purpose behind all this. And you might look out there right now, and maybe it seems as though there's no purpose. God is saying to Job, but there is a purpose, Job, and you know it. All right? You weren't there, but you got to trust me for the purpose. And just when you look out there, it might look like there's no purpose, but there is. All right? And something else at verse 7, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Well, who would that be? It has to be. It can't be Job's. It can't be Job's descendants. It has to be angels. Well, why, if Job is a picture, if the book of Job is a picture of Job under satanic captivity, and it's going to take God to turn his captivity, why tell Job that when God did what he did in verse 5, 6, and 7, why even bring up to Job that verse 7, that the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Why even tell Job that? What's that? Okay, but yes, why else? Why else might they do that? Tell you what, look a little bit further ahead. Watch this. He says, or who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth as if it had issued out of the womb? When I made the cloud the garment thereof and thick darkness a swaddling band for it and break up it for my decreed place. That's interesting. God broke up for it his decreed place and set bars and doors and said, hitherto shalt thou come, but no further. And here shall thy proud waves be stayed. What's it sound like is going on there? If you're trying to stay some proud waves, what's going on? Yeah, you got a rebellion going on there, right? He says at verse 12, hast thou commanded the morning since thy days and caused the dayspring to know his place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth. Why? Why would somebody want to do that? That the wicked might be shaken out of it. See, there's obviously all these questions that God is asking Job, God is conveying to Job that, Job, when you look at the creation out there, you got to understand that just like you are under satanic captivity, so too there is a curse on creation, and it is under satanic captivity. And when I set all this up, I set all this up on purpose. Not just a place for me to come and dwell, but to destroy the rebellion out of my universe. And this, all these questions that God asked Job, it's amazing how God, in asking Job questions, is teaching Job doctrine. Do I ask a lot of questions? I ask a lot of questions, right? Why? Makes you think. All of these questions that God asked Job, every single one of them is conveying information to Job for his edification and learning about what it's going to take in order to turn Job's captivity. So back to the issue. Look at verse 4. It is turned into clay. It is turned as clay to the seal. That's kind of a weird statement. And they stand as a garment. And from the wicked their light is withholden, and the high arm shall be broken. That was verse 15, 38, 15. What's this thing about the wicked? Their light's going to be withholden from them, and the high arm shall be broken. You see how implied in all, it conveyed in all these questions is this fact that there's a high arm out there. There's somebody proud out there. There's the wicked out there. He's got to be destroyed and will be destroyed. See that? If you look, he talks a little bit further down about the hail, the snow. Look down at verse 22. Hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow, or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail? Now watch verse 23. Which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle and war. Now in that verse, well, you know, we look at snow and hail and say, "Wow, this is amazing! What a piece of creation by God! Hail and snow, and snow is great because we can ski on it and throw snowballs at each other and that kind of thing." But in those verses, what does God say the reason is that He created the snow and the hail? As armor, as munitions. Understand that? You've already gotten a foretaste of that in the events of the book of Exodus. Now, I don't mean you, and Job didn't know it and so forth, but when you go read the book of Exodus, doesn't he use great hail, mingled with fire, runs along the ground, smashes some people and so forth? And he tells you right there. So if you go back then to verse 7, when he tells Job about all this, he says, Job, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. What did they sing about and what caused them such great joy? If the sons of God were the angels there, what'd you say? No, yeah, knowing that what's going on, when they saw God create what He does in the 6 days of creation, and they shout for joy, they understand that what God was doing, He was doing for the purpose of stilling the enemy and the avenger. That He was doing it for the purpose of one day settling the score, settling the battle. And they shouted for joy. Now, why would the angels have shouted for joy about all that? What happened among the angels? A satanic rebellion. The upper echelon of the angels went with the adversary. And it appears as though that the adversary convinced at least a third of the angels to go with him. Michael indicates that the book of Daniel indicates that only two of the main princes of the angels remained faithful, Michael and Gabriel. All the other ones left. He says, Michael, your prince, we stand with you in these things. That's not exactly how he says it in Daniel, okay? But so now you see the angels, when you think back, okay, the angels, they see this rebellion occur. They see the upper echelon of the angels attempt a coup d'etat against God, the Creator, and so forth. And the average, quote-unquote, foot soldier among the angels does not rebel. Most of them don't. A lot of them do, but the upper echelon, they go. And so among the angels, as they see God do the things that He does in Genesis chapter number 1, the 6 days of creation, the angels see God doing that, and they shout for joy. Because they understand that God is doing that as part of His plan and purpose to settle the score. To demonstrate that those angels that went with the adversary made the wrong choice. Understand what's going on here? Now, so let's say that you're up there with the angels. And I know I'm off track a little bit here, okay? From the book of Job. But that's okay. Let's say that you're up there among the angels, which you're not, okay? But let's just say you are. And let's say that you were part of the angels that did not rebel. And you see God doing what He does on day number one. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And God says, let there be light. So He turns on the light so the angels can start seeing what He does on day number two, day number three, four, five, six. He creates the plants. He creates the sun, moon, and star. He creates the heavenly bodies to give light and time on the earth and so forth. He creates the birds, the fish, the beasts that walk. And then He creates this creature called man. This thing called man. Now, they'd seen the face of a man before, because remember, they'd seen the cherubim, and the cherubim have four faces, one of which is a man. So they've seen the face of a man before. And so they see God, you know, God's planing the dirt down there, right? And then He gets His face all muddy and dirty because He breathes into this dirt, the breath of life, and up pops this creature. And then they hear God say to man that, you're going to run this for me. Have dominion over all this. Subdue it. Replenish it. And the angels hear God saying that to man and understand that God is turning all things over now to man, and man is to run this for God. And then what happens? Up comes the adversary and says to man, oh, by the way, remember when they saw God do all this, they're shouting for joy, right? Singing songs of praise in anticipation of the rebellion being crushed. Man is created. They see that. They rejoice at that. Here's a man that's going to run this for us. And then up comes the adversary. Yea, hath God said. And then what happens? Man agrees with the adversary. And the fall occurs. So now what do you suppose the angels did? Oh, man. Yeah, oh, man. You know. Now what do we do? And so forth. And then all down through the Old Testament, you see this constant battle between, almost like a chess match, between God and the adversary, God and the adversary, God and the God does this, Satan comes along and does that. God does this, Satan comes along and does that. God does this, Satan comes along and does that. All the way through with the nations, with the call of Abraham, and before that, by the way, with the flood and so forth, the call of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and various, you all down through history. And, you know, God makes this move, Satan makes that move. God makes this move, Satan makes that move, and so forth. And then, of course, ultimately, God makes this move, presents the Messiah right on time. Satan makes this move. He's inspired God's nation, who now is in satanic captivity, to crucify their own Messiah. And Satan says, I gotcha. Satan says, checkmate. And God says, well, hold on just a second there. I got another move over here. You know, and of course you understand part about that where Paul says, had Satan known the mystery, he would not have crucified the Lord of glory. It was the move, the one, if there was ever any decision that Satan would like to change, it's not his decision in his initial rebellion. He has never second-guessed that. It's the crucifixion of Christ. Well, back to Job here, because I'm way off track here. But back to Job here. What's going on now is God is explaining to Job that Job, what your difficulties, your struggles, your hardship, the calamity, you losing your family, the physical calamity and so forth. Job, what that's all about, it's part of my plan and purpose to destroy the rebellion out of my universe. So Job, I need you to think about these questions like a man. Understand that as a man you were created as part of my plan and purpose to still the enemy and avenger. There's an enemy out there. There's an avenger out there that has a dispute over my authority over the earth and the heavenly places, by the way, as well. And I created man, Job, I created you for the purpose of participation and participating with me in destroying the enemy and the avenger. Okay? I would encourage you between now and next week, go and read these chapters again. Would you do that? Job 38 down over to chapter 41. Go and read them again and just think through those questions. But think through those questions from the standpoint, not like this. A lot of times you'll hear people read those questions and say, oh, I wonder what he's talking about. Don't do that. Say, wait a minute. God, you asked this question on purpose, and there is an answer to the question in your word. And the question is designed to convey information, to convey doctrine about the destruction of the adversary. So when you read all those questions, think about the questions that way. Okay? Okay, any questions this morning? We're out of time here. Any questions on Job?
I don't have a question, but most Christians
don't at all understand the big picture. That is so true. Yeah. The standard way that book is Job is taught as though it's a devotional kind of a thing. And Job is not at all a purpose book about a devotion. I mean, it really is a tremendous picture of the fact that it's going to take God to turn Job's captivity. That Job is under the satanic captivity. There is a big rebellion going on. So you're right. Yes, go ahead.
You can kind of see, though, why people do that because of the condition. It is a little confusing.
Yeah.
God chose Job.
Yeah. Remember, though, at the time that this is happening in Job, they're not under that conditional system of blessing and cursing. That's right. Yeah, Job is the third son of Issachar. He travels down into Egypt. Israel is not under the law until after they come out of Egypt. Moses is not even born yet. He's not even alive during the time that this all occurs and so forth. All right. So, but what's kind of interesting about that, Beth, is that as you listen to the logic and reason of his quote unquote three friends and so forth, they do say that concept. They suggested, they just flat out say to Job, that Job, the reason you're suffering is because you've sinned. And God's chastising you because of your sin. And that isn't what's going on with Job. You know? But they didn't know that. Okay? Okay, the question is, so why is Job placed where it is? You mean in the sequence of the Bible, right? You don't mean himself personally in history, okay? All right, that is such a great question. Think about, look at the index in your Bible. Look at the sequence of the books in the Old Testament. Job is the oldest book in the Bible, but it's not first in the Bible. And the question is why? Why is it where it is? You've got Genesis through Esther. And what did we say that was there? That was a picture of Israel's what? That's their history. That's their background. What's the very next book? It's Job. You see that there? You go Genesis through Esther, and then you've got Job. So why is Job here instead of, say, before Genesis? Why do we need the information in Genesis 1 through Esther in order to have an appreciation of Job being next? What do you think that might be? That's exactly right. Yeah. Because if the point of the book of Job is under this satanic captivity, he's an Israelite, and it's going to take God to turn Job's captivity, we need some background information as to who Israel is anyway, and where all the satanic rebellion came from, what it's all about. We need some information about, well, the earth. And so that's why you get the history of who they are, where they came from. You understand before the book of Job that there is a battle over the earth, right? Exodus chapter number 19, when he brings Israel out of Egypt, all the earth is mine. And so Job comes along after you've gotten that groundwork, that foundation of the history of Israel and what's going on with the earth and so forth at that time. Job comes along and now says, what this is all about is a satanic rebellion. And so you get the information here and you can go, oh, that's what was going on back there. So that's why it's here, okay? That is a great question, by the way. It really is. Okay? Okay, any other questions or comments or anything?
Well, I just noticed a pattern.
Okay, good. Let's go. What's that? Oh, Rich, did you have a question?
You mentioned
after Abraham. Because it would be... Yeah, see, it would be Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob is the one that has the 12 sons, remember? One of them is Issachar. And he's the third son of Issachar. And if you want the cross-reference to that, let me just give it to you here real quick. And then go back and look at it. So he's part of the group that initially goes down into Egypt with, write down Genesis 46:13. He's part of that group that initially goes down into Egypt when Joseph is the second in command and he brings his father, the 70 souls, in and so forth. He's part of that group. So that's, again, so, you know, so Moses is not even alive by that point. The law is not given by that point. All right. Does that clarify that? 46:13. Okay, let's go ahead and take about a 10-minute break and then we'll get started.